The presidential election in the US is over, or at least technically over, although many points of contention remain. And the most surprising outcome of the election is not so much that the political surveyors and pundits were wrong about how the election would proceed and the numbers that would come out of it. It's not that there was divisiveness, certainly, in the process. It's not that certain people are celebrating while others are fighting to maintain that the outcome was illegitimate. It's not that allegations of fraud are being brought forward. The most surprising part of the election is the small or relatively small number of voters on which it turned. I say surprising, but maybe that's not really surprising. This is a pattern that has repeated itself for the majority of elections in recent decades, certainly since second Bush in 2000. Most of the country knows how it's going to vote. Many vote along party lines, but others see two candidates rising out of the primaries and are almost instantly sure for whom they're going to be voting. That leaves a relatively narrow margin, those who consider themselves centrist, those who can't stand either candidate but want to vote nonetheless, and these people control the outcome of an election such that the other 48% of people, give or take, will remain unhappy for the next 4 to 8 years. It's a little bit of an absurd pattern, but it represents the fact that we have so little common ground on most elections. There is no party of the people in that regard. There is a party that appeals to the majority of beliefs and wishes of slightly less than one half of the country, and a party that does the same for the other slightly less than one half of the country. And perhaps the most disturbing aspect of this is that the majority of centrist voters are not, as you would expect, centrist because they believe in moderation, or they reject the extremes, or they can see the appeals of both sides, but also they can see the downsides of both sides. There certainly are centrist voters this way, but studies have shown that the majority of centrist voters are centrist because they are not educated enough about politics to have a strong opinion. They hear things about both sides, they hear good things, they hear bad things, and they have trouble making up their mind. And this is not an insult to any one particular person or any group of people. In fact, many of this kind of centrist voter are intelligent and educated people. The kind of education we're talking about is not, did you go to college, or are you able to solve some kind of puzzle? This is an education about politics. And the centrist voters are centrist because they just don't care enough. Is that bad? You could say that it is somebody's civic duty to inform themselves about the issues of the day, but it would be going a little overboard to say that a person is a bad person for not wanting to invest so much time and effort in coming to understand everything that's necessary to make a truly informed decision. And in fact, you could certainly say that recognizing that you don't know and are not likely to know enough to be able to make a really good informed decision about two parties which you maybe don't favor either one of is in some ways more legitimate than falling into the bucket of one party and considering yourself a member of that party, noting the things that go right, ignoring the things that go wrong for that party, and being satisfied with where you are. It's a little bit disingenuous, and it certainly doesn't help the outcome of an election for the country. But what do these centrist voters really represent? They represent that our political axes revolve around a center that still exists. There are 300 some odd million people in this country with different backgrounds, different cultures, different stories, living vastly different ways of life in parts of the country that geographically, physically, environmentally are very distinct from one another. The concerns, the interests, some of these supersede local environments, but some of them are very much tied to where you live. A rancher in Montana, an urbanite in New York City, a small business owner in suburbia. They all have threads that connect them, but they come from very different places. And trying to get all of these millions and millions of people in disparate areas with disparate needs to agree on fundamental issues, so much so that you could produce an encompassing policy and many encompassing policies and laws that would unite them, is nearly madness. And yet we have to do that if we want any kind of unity. Of course, that's not how it comes out in practice, though. Whoever has more power and more control of the federal government at a given time simply tries to force their views, which they view as the right ones, the right views, onto the country as a whole for everyone's benefit. Of course, those who do not have the control at the time do not view it as for their benefit. So when a more left-leaning president and a left-leaning House and Senate try to pass healthcare laws. People on the right view this as oppressive, raising taxes, restricting choices, but the people in power feel like they are doing it to help, to give people healthcare. And when there is a more right-leaning president in power, a more right-leaning House and Senate, they'll pass protections for businesses, or perhaps bolster the Second Amendment, feeling they're giving people more economy, they're giving people more autonomy and freedom, and that it will be good for everyone, while the people on the left feel like businesses are being promoted over the individual and dangerous guns are staying on the street. So you see, it's a very difficult thing. When you get right down to it, there's only so much a federal government can do to create overarching policies that will apply to everyone, not for lack of trying. It's a large country with a lot of different people. And unless we want to go the way of China and become very authoritarian and very autocratic, it's inevitable that we're going to run into this issue. Of course, we know we need a federal government. There are some who would deny this, anarchists of various breeds, whether socialist or capitalist. But experiences like the Articles of Confederation proved, I believe, that even at that time, there was a need for a federal system that had some leverage, some power. A total or near total absence of an ability to unite the states with any amount of rigor is doomed to failure. You could make the argument that it would be morally and ethically, philosophically preferable if we could maintain such a minimal state, a minarchy as some put it, but whether that would work in practice seems dubious. So you need some federal system, some way of bringing the states together as a united state. You need a system that binds them, something that applies to the entire country. And yet, if it has too much uniform control over such disparate elements, disparate states, disparate people, we encounter inevitable issues that only seem to grow with time. This is where the state governments and the local governments come in, and we always seem to give them less of a voice in our own head than perhaps we ought. I've often heard people from other countries who view the American system from outside express wonder, concern, and even some disdain at the American notion of having such strongly independent states. Many countries have states, and many of them have some level of autonomy, but not usually to the extent in the United States, or they have a stronger national system. Here, certainly, it seems like we struggle to put federal enactments into motion, some that are applied are later dissolved. Even executive orders don't seem to have the impact you would expect. But there's some good in that. This country was built specifically to have a federal system that was in potential quick to act, but slow to decide, slow to change. Any federal bureaucracy that was too quick at coming to decisions and enacting laws was viewed as highly suspect and potentially dangerous. And if you don't believe me, you can go peruse the Federalist Papers, which is a good idea anyway. But the outcome of this way of governing, this way of bringing together states while leaving them with the majority of power rather than the federal system, looks from the outside like a kind of barely controlled chaos. You have states constantly vying with each other, trying to pull away from federal mandates, do their own thing, trying to use the legislative and judicial branches to exert control over one another, bring other states into line, bring themselves into line, local jurisdictions that try to defy laws at the state level that they view as inappropriate or not applying to their locales. And not only does this happen, but it changes constantly as at the local, state, and federal level, new politicians come and go, new policies change. Not even every 4 years or 8 years with a president, but every 2 years with other elected officials. But this controlled chaos is as much a benefit as it is a downside, perhaps more so. I think the phrase goes, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. The constant internal turmoil, as long as it remains within a certain bound, is, as they say in the software world, a feature, not a bug. It can be maddening, frustrating, it can be loud and raucous. You can feel like things are going back and forth and never really settling, but that is what makes it a living democracy. 300-some-odd million people, all trying to live their lives the best way they can, all coming with their own backgrounds, their own perspectives, all, or most, trying to do right by themselves and those around them and their fellow countrymen. It's inevitable that there will be this conflict, but that's okay, because the discussions, the debates, even the yelling and shouting that happen is constructive at its root. And while we need to be careful to keep it within bounds, keep it reasonable, keep it productive, the conflict itself lends a vibrancy and a dynamism to this country that would otherwise lead to stagnation and decay. So maybe really it's not at all a surprise that the election would turn on a handful, relative handful, of centrist voters. They simply represent the eternal indecisiveness of a country that is constantly moving, growing, changing. We have so many people, each with their own thoughts to contribute, and that's good. Even when it seems like we're at loggerheads and we have more division now than ever, we have more potential to innovate than ever. More potential for change, more potential for growth. Sure, there will be growing pains, and if you're caught up in the middle of that, it can be terrible. But we'll come out the other side of it, or we have the potential to come out on the other side of it if we do things right, with a higher quality of life, new ideas, new standards, new ways of handling the country. Division needs to be reined in so that it doesn't turn into real discord. But if we can be civil about it, then our disagreements, our arguments, our debates can be one of the best things that can ever happen for our country.